I mean, there was no pathway to success at all. I just literally took a drill and started drilling into the mountain.
It's How to Be Amazing, brought to you by PRX. I'm Michael Ian Black. I would like to introduce today's guest by way of anecdote. So the other day, I was acting in a music video, because I'm very famous, and one of the extras started chatting with me. He was a young kid, he's probably early 20s, and he told me that he wanted to be the next Ryan Gosling, and he asked if I had any advice, and I asked him the same thing that I ask every actor who wants advice. I said, "Do you write?" My guest today, Felicia Day, figured that lesson out for herself after trying and failing to make it as an actress in Hollywood by the regular route. She's a violin and math whiz who started college at age 16, and Felicia Day was used to having things come easily for her. But after her move to Los Angeles, she quickly realized that she didn't fit the Hollywood standard. Felicia dealt with her disappointment by losing herself for a time in an all-consuming video game addiction, but then she did something to change her life. At 7:45 p.m. on December 31st, 2006, Felicia Day finished the first draft of her script about a quirky group of gamers, a subject she knew a lot about. That script became The Guild, a web series that made her an internet rock star and led her to a successful career as an actress, writer, producer, and entrepreneur. Here are the opening lines of The Guild's first episode.
So, it's Friday night, and still jobless, yay. I haven't left the house in a week. My therapist broke up with me. Oh yeah, there's a gnome warlock in my living room, sleeping on my couch.
Her new memoir, You're Never Weird on the Internet, almost, tells her story. Felicia Day, welcome to How to Be Amazing.
Well, thank you very much for having me here.
So, it's New Year's Eve, 2006, heading into 2007. You've given yourself a deadline after procrastinating for like a year.
I'm very good at it.
As we all are.
Yeah.
To write something. Tell me what that moment meant to you as you, I mean, you know the time that you finished the draft. Tell me what that meant to you to just have that completed script in your hands.
I started sobbing because I finally made myself do something that was terrifying to me, and I never thought that I would finish, and I forced myself to write dirty and ugly, and I don't think I've ever felt a sense of accomplishment quite like that. I think I was always afraid of creating because I'm such a perfectionist that I couldn't put words on a page, and the bar was too high. I set the bar too high for myself in life, and especially in writing, and in that moment that I made myself finish something, that was the accomplishment, and everything else was gravy after that.
So just writing, just even getting that first draft done, that was the accomplishment for you.
Yeah, I think because when you have nothing, it's, I don't know if you play video games, it's kind of like when you're in a new video game and you're on a new map and there's always a fog, the fog of war. So everything's grayed out until you start walking through it and discovering like a building here, a monster here. And I kind of think of writing like that, in that the really hard part is uncovering the map and seeing what's there. And then all the rewrites are just cleaning up the monsters, mm-hmm. stealing everything from all the chests. So, I think that fear of the unknown and the fear of not being enough and the fear of putting down something that's not quite special enough keeps a lot of people from doing things. And that's kind of one of the reasons why I wrote the book, because that bravery is inherent in putting something down that will last beyond yourself.
When you say you set the bar too high in sitting down to just write this script, in your mind, where was the bar? What was the bar you were trying to reach?
I think the bar is, and ultimately this is what I found through writing my memoir, is that the bar was always about other people and what they would expect from me, how they would measure me, how my work would measure up against other people. And I think that external praise was a great motivator in my life up until then. You know, I think that was part of the reason why I became an actor. I think being an actor, you know, like I am a people pleaser, and you walk into a room and it's inherent in the job for people to like you, right?
So rarely get that external praise.
Oh.
But you don't know my wife. Continue.
Okay.
I'm sorry, continue.
Okay. So I think that motivated me a lot and got me into situations where I was not happy, because I was always looking for other people to validate me. And the idea that I could go ahead and put something down on paper that maybe wasn't good for everybody or anybody but myself felt like a fool's errand. And when I forced myself to do it just for myself, it was as if I was taking care of myself for the first time.
You talk about being a perfectionist, and it seems like everything in your life leading up to at least leaving for Hollywood and becoming an actress really was about being a perfectionist. You grew up in the South. You were kind of a violin prodigy, a math prodigy. Well, you could consider yourself a math prodigy as well?
I mean, I was very good at it. I was doing calculus at really young age, but I don't ever feel like I was a prodigy per se. I think reflecting on it, I think anybody can excel in areas in a quote unquote extraordinary way, because the way people are taught in school is to kind of all stay together as a herd. And I don't think that's human nature. All of us excel at certain things and are bad at certain things. And I think math just happened to be the one that I excelled at. And because I had no schooling around me, I just excelled until I felt comfortable. Right. And it just happened to be a little bit farther with math.
You were homeschooled in a kind of unusual way. I mean, I think most people think of homeschooling in this country, at least, as having generally a kind of religious component. Yours didn't have that.
Not at all. No religion whatsoever. I mean, you know. Totally up to you if you are into that kind of thing. But my mother was more of a hippie. Mm-hmm. So we recycled before it was cool. It was a hipster recyclers. And essentially, I was unschooled. So my mother really...
You were feral.
I was a feral child. I like that. I was feral. I had a very strict television schedule, as I describe in the book. And between the television schedule, I'd fit, you know, studying in. I never really took a class or a test other than like the SAT to get into college. And that it was a jarring situation to get into college, having been untested in so many ways. But I do believe that the way I was raised led to who I am today, which is somebody who embraces a lot of things that are non-standard.
Right. So were you kind of self-directed in terms of what you studied?
I was absolutely self-directed. I put a little timetable in the book about like, hey, 9 o'clock, get up, 10, lost in space, 11, maybe do some math. I was very self-motivated in that I liked learning, and my brother was not as self-motivated. So I think he wandered a lot more in life, but he's still a very accomplished person. He just happened to do a different path than I did. I would be looking through my school books by myself because I really wanted to finish this, you know, math book. I didn't gravitate toward the sciences. I'm very ignorant in chemistry and physics.
I'll lay it all out for you.
Yeah, will you really? Okay, great.
Yeah, no problem.
Just we'll
do a summary. It's about peptide bonds. That's all you need to know.
Oh, pretty. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I have kind of a hodgepodge education in some areas, but I'm very good at noir films and musicals. Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, worst movie, but still best.
And yet, surprisingly... maybe not surprisingly. I mean, it seems like for most people, the stuff in which they're interested, like noir or musicals or whatever, ends up being the stuff they gravitate towards in their professional lives as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it raises the question of how we educate in general. And it seems like the model that you followed, a kind of self-directed model where you get enough science, you get enough physics, but you really get to delve into the things that you love, has been really beneficial for you.
Yeah, that's kind of like college. I mean, in college, you get a little bit more leeway about studying and concentrating on things that you're really good at. But when you're a kid, you kind of are just part of the class and you're always trying to take tests, really. It's all about passing the test versus right. Learning for the love of learning. And I love learning. I listen to podcasts, history podcasts in my car all the time. I love trying to learn a new language when I travel. I like reading all sorts of fiction and nonfiction. And if I'm not learning something, I feel like I'm dying inside a little bit. So that's just a motivator for me. But yeah, I think one of the reasons I wrote the book was that I see a lot of peer pressure, especially with young girls, to abandon the things that they don't look like. So there's cliches that society imposes upon all of us the way we were born, men and women, whatever race, religion, background. And people say, oh, that's you shouldn't be into that because you don't look like you'd be into that or something. And that really sells a lot of us short. It's almost a form of bullying to make somebody abandon something that they're interested in because they're ashamed of it, because they're not fitting in or to somebody else's idea of who they are.
Did you ever feel that as a child?
I mean, as a child, not really, because the only exposure I had to other people were joyous, like dance class where everyone loved dance, or orchestra where everyone loved orchestra, or musical theater, or video games, because I connected with people online about video games. So my life has revolved about being supported in my interests. And I don't think that's a commonality in life. Certainly, I wasn't rejected enough as a kid, because that's really hard for me as an adult. But definitely, I think once I got out of that environment and I tell somebody, hey, I'm into games, they're like, you don't look like you'd be into games, or that's ridiculous, or what's your problem? And that sort of demeaning kind of attitude, I think, would be very hard as a kid when you're formative and trying to fit in and be liked, to hang on to those things.
What was your first real exposure to that? Was that in college, when you felt like you were being judged for the first time?
I don't think it's so much in college, because I was, again, I was always surrounded by people who were really passionate about the music, the mathematics. I was always supported a lot. I think it was more when I got into Hollywood. I mean, I jumped from this weird bubble to college, where you excel based on how hard you work and how good you are. You get straight A's, which I, you know, is very, very firmly ensconced in my A's. And then I go to Hollywood, doop-de-doo, I'm going to be famous. Look at me, I'm sitting on the corner. Why am I not discovered?
Right.
And then I realize it's not a merit-based society, Hollywood. It's not, hey, you're definitely working the hardest, you get ahead. It's just not what it is. And because you're judged on your external appearances quite a bit, and your first impression when you walk through the door is what you look like, a lot of the times I felt like I was pigeonholed instantly in something that I didn't feel like on the inside. I even had a casting director one time say, you know, your insides don't match your outsides. That's a very big criticism.
What does that even mean?
I didn't know, but I didn't get the job. So, I felt the pressure to conform to what people saw in me, which was this oddball kind of character-y actor that didn't really have any emotional arc at all, that would flavor the landscape in a very insignificant way, because I just wasn't attractive enough or bland enough to associate with romantically or emotionally. So I felt very marginalized. And the harder I worked to fit in, the more I sort of made a cliche of myself that I kind of started hating. And that's what drove me into video game addiction. And then I got out of that and wrote a story about that. So.
And I want to talk about that, but I do want to backtrack just a smidge, though, because I feel like we sort of glossed over the double major in specifically violin or music.
Violin performance.
Okay, violin performance and math.
Mathematics, yeah.
Which, obviously, the two are related in a lot of ways and sort of unrelated in other ways. But nowhere sort of in the conversation from feral child to mathematician. And violinist is this acting, the idea of acting. And I wonder why abandon mathematics and violin performance, why abandon it for Hollywood, which seems so kind of, I don't know.
Trivial? You have a look on your face that you just don't know why.
I mean, I guess I feel like, because I'm thinking to myself, if I had loved mathematics enough to pursue it as a major, would I just sort of say, thanks, math, but I'm going to go be an actor now?
I always did theater when I was growing up. My aunt was an actor, and she was a musical theater actress. And she instilled in me early on, she made me audition for plays. And as I moved around, my dad was in the military. That was one of the reasons why I was homeschooled, because we moved so often. The one thread that was common in my life was technology and doing really small, lame community theater. Mm-hmm. So I played like the orphan in Oliver like 4 times. I was a prostitute in Sweet Charity 3 times. You know, always very tangential, you know, before the age of 14, prostitution. But that's a very great musical. So
the minute you walked in the joint, I could see you were a man of distinction, a real big spender, good looking. So refined.
All of those things were the biggest social bonds that, you know, trying to connect with people online and hanging out on the theater stage rehearsing that dance where we all have our cups and we're like, Oliver, you know. So I think that love of community and belonging was always kind of something I wanted to pursue.
Were there people in your life going, Felicia, you should really be an actress?
No one. Yeah. No one. That's why I got a math degree, because my dad was like, you have to get a backup degree. You know, that backup thing. And music, I had a full scholarship for, and I really loved doing. And I worked as a musician through college. And I think, you know, I think I would have been suited to stay a musician. But I think I had a big ego and I wanted to be a star. And there was this weird drive in me that I just wanted to be a soloist. And I knew I really wasn't good enough. I hadn't gotten serious fast enough, because you have to be a savant at 12 and you're just on a stage in order to make it like that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to play Handel's Messiah for the 50,000th time when I was, you know, 25.
Right, but you'd be happy to be the prostitute in Sweet Charity when you're 25.
It's a good point. Had you been back there, I might still be a musician. I'm not sure. I just had this sense like I need to try it.
I'm playing dime store psychologist now. I have no idea. But was some of it about kind of the isolation of being homeschooled and not having that kind of social interaction and seeking it online and seeking it in community theater? And did that sort of manifest itself, do you think, into becoming an actor?
I think so. I think that sense of community and belonging. I mean, I think playing in an orchestra is an amazing experience. And I think I wanted to duplicate that by going to Hollywood, that feeling of being in a community theater. And I think that was the naive sort of drive that I had that obviously was proven completely wrong by being just a Damon journeyman actor who was just begging to be a part of any production for a day, sitting, you know, in a small chair in the corner and then be like, hey, bye. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until I started doing my own thing and creating my own family, a community that no one could kick me out of at the end of the day, that I felt that sense of meaning. And so I think it was just me being completely blind, willful, jumping headfirst into something that I thought I loved, but I think an aspect of it was something that was not present in the professional life of an actor.
Why Hollywood instead of New York when you had such a strong background in musical theater?
I wanted to be on film. I think my aunt's experience on stage was kind of proof that it's really hard to make it as a stage actor.
Right. Super easy, though, to just become a movie
star. Is it really
super
easy? Yeah. Tap dancing?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, to get
big money.
I mean, as opposed to like just being a movie star, like that's easy. In your mind, you're like, I'll just go to Hollywood, I'll become a star.
I also volunteered for a lot of film festivals over the years while I was in college. So I volunteered for the Austin Film Festival, South by Southwest. I went to Sundance a couple of times. And that indie spirit, I've always been just a sort of a counterculture outsider indie spirit. And I love busting the system. So I wanted to be a part of that. And somehow that added up to Hollywood, because all those people from Sundance were from Hollywood. It was really an uneducated leap into nothing that ended up being fulfilling in a way. But ultimately it was.
So you show up in Hollywood. Did you have any support system there? Did you know people?
I knew a lot of people through the Austin Film Festival.
Okay.
So I did know people. And they all gave me advice that I promptly rejected about staying with the violin and doing all these things. I got involved in some very bad acting classes. And, you know, I it was a rough time. And especially somebody who'd been the little star of the music building and always ahead of the curve and big fish in a little pond. Like, that was a really... It was hard to send my headshot out to, you know, 200 agents and not get one response.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like this was the first time in your life, and you said so, where you didn't have that support, where suddenly you weren't excelling.
Yeah.
And how did you, first of all, how did you even recognize that? I mean, was there a moment where you're like, oh, shit, like I kind of suck here?
I think that I had a strong will that somehow is going to break through. Somehow I'm going to keep going. It's just one other class. It's just one other cast director workshop. It's just one more two lines on a soap opera that's really going to make my career. As long as I can hobble together. And eventually, very quickly, actually, I paid my bills. So it wasn't as if I was struggling really, really badly. I became very, very good at commercial acting, mm-hmm. removing my soul from my body and showing up and being a prop. And I would get huge national commercials where I would get paid a year's salary in a day.
And yeah, with this GE profile, you get smart dispense technology, each tuition weight sensors, and it's ENERGY STAR rated. And I'm thinking you might like the color.
And I'm sure you're familiar with those kind of jobs that there you go. You check the box, so your bills are paid, and it doesn't matter if you're not really doing what you love every day. You have no excuse because you're making a living.
Right.
And there's always the hope that okay, well, I'm floating myself for 6 months. I got my bills paid. It's going to be that next audition. It's going to be the next audition. And that happened, you know, for years. And occasionally you get enough jobs to sort of lift the bubbling hope up again once you start to sink really low.
Right. That's what I think a lot of people who have this dream don't understand, that it can't be that. It can be years, like years of just kind of suffering through this, through this just meat machine that is the entertainment industry. And eventually it caught up with you. And you said earlier, you started behaving like this image that was being projected onto you as opposed to who you were. What was that image?
I was like a quirky stalker secretary. I mean, it was a very specific role, usually with laundry. So if you did a montage of all my sort of one-off jobs, I would have a basket of laundry and several cats in my house and some glasses and an anthropology wardrobe. And it just became the special. And I actually was very successful at that sort of image. It worked very well, especially in commercials, and was a career. I mean, I can't deny it was a career, but it was not something that I was fulfilled with. And now that I'm on the other side of the camera frequently, I understand how the process gets the way it does. Creativity is disposable. There is such a influx of it that you have to be ruthless and just treat people like cattle. I totally understand, and I have done it myself in a very ashamed way, but the impact of emotion that has on the people who create is just terrible. And that's why people get bitter and angry.
Right. And in your case, addicted to World of Warcraft.
Yes. So I started playing that game when my brother invited me.
The Iron Horde will prevail. And all that stand against us will die.
Storm the portal!
Rise up, Iron Horde. Bring your war chief with it. This was not our destiny.
I played other online games during my life, Diablo and, you know, other MMOs, Puzzle Pirates, you know, things that I encountered other people online. And that sort of emotional bond with people who are outside the industry, really, and just playing a game with me, was so fulfilling and felt like I belonged somewhere and they weren't judging me for my successes or failures in the business. And it got to the point where I would just play more and more and more because it was there all the time. And there was inevitably somebody online to hang out with. And it became destructive. And eventually I realized that I need to give this up. So I did.
But, I mean, you wrote in your book that you spent thousands of hours, and then you say literally hundreds of days.
Yeah.
And you write about how it was 12, 14 hours a day, 16 hours a day, whatever it was. Was some of it about this kind of perfectionism in you, where you could go on a raid with your friends and the results are so measurable, you could look at them very easily and say, I've succeeded in this?
Absolutely. There are benchmarks. You're putting in effort equaled achievement. Putting in a plan, having a plan equaled reward. And it was very simple, breaking down steps into pieces, giving me rewards along the way, having a group of people to enjoy those rewards with and have common goals with people. That was very appealing. And I don't think inherently video games are addictive. I think that if you're in a bad place and you don't have this self-awareness enough to know that it's a Band-Aid you're putting on your life, then sometimes things can get out of hand. And I think that was what happened to me for like a year and a half.
Did you have that awareness? I mean, were you aware at the time that you were in the kind of throes of this addictive behavior?
I was, and I tried to quit several times. And, you know, I'm a very compulsive person. That's just part of my personality. And I go to the max throttle. It's zero, 100 with me. And that's just my personality. And it's great in some ways, but it's terrible in others. And in that way it was. And I would go to sleep at night sort of almost wanting to cry. But the 12 hours I was playing, I felt satisfied. And then I stopped and then I felt empty. And when I started feeling very empty and not even being able to dream anything but video games, then I had to get ruthless because it was affecting my life in a bad way.
Mm-hmm. Was that the only kind of compulsive or addictive behavior you've ever had? Was it really just about video games?
Yeah, I think it was only video games. I think that I do have probably an addictive personality, but I don't particularly like drinking. I think I'm a little allergic to alcohol and drugs are expensive. Give you like meth teeth.
Yeah, you don't want those meth teeth.
No, I like cupcakes, but I'm vain. So, I mean, I think that was the one kind of trigger area where I did find such a sense of fulfillment and belonging my whole life, so that I naturally gravitated toward it when I wanted to escape.
Right. So how did you stop ultimately?
I had a support group that I was a part of that I talk about, some women who got together and were like, hey, I did this this week. I did this this week. I played video games all week. And eventually the shame wore me down. And I decided to write something because they were being writers and they were directing and accomplishing a lot of things. And I set a goal for myself to write a pilot, just completely out of the air. Like, yeah, I'm going to write a gaming pilot. And it took 4 months to even get it, my stuff together. And like you said in the beginning, I set a goal and I was like, you're going to do this no matter what, or you're literally a failure in life. I had a series of panic attacks where I finished that script out of sheer fear. And it was great. I mean, it was a good experience ultimately, but not great to live through.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm just sort of idly wondering now, is that the best way to create when you're sitting there going, if you don't finish this at such and such date, you're literally the biggest failure in the world.
No pressure, but you might as well just not exist. I don't think it's the best way to create. I think that I have come over the last, you know, since the year since, I've, especially after writing this book, to be honest with you, I felt like the need to be perfect has been lifted from my heart a little bit. And the fear that pressure is inextricably linked with the genius or the good stuff. You know, I think because as artists, I know we have this mythology like, hey, you have to be screwed up in order to be great.
Right.
If you take away the screwed up parts, you're nothing. You're just a plebe. And I think part of me, that anxiety that ruled me, I attributed to my success and therefore couldn't even contemplate another way of being without that anxiety to accomplish what I have or accomplish more. And I think that I've grown up in a sense that I don't think I need that. I think freeing myself from that cage has actually led to more fruitful ideas and hopefully bigger
things.
What
has freed you from it?
I think completely burning out. I had like the biggest burnout ever where I almost quit everything. I was like, I'm going to move to Portland and wear Birkenstocks and start an artisan coffee pour over place because that sounds fancy.
Mm-hmm. That sounds fancy.
It is not a bad...
I mean, not the Birkenstocks, but the rest of it
sounds
fancy.
Yeah, they're never pretty, are they? I don't care how hip you are. I'm sorry, ladies. But yeah.
Yeah, you had like a breakdown.
I had a complete burnout. And I reading up on burnout online, I'm like, oh, that's me. And then some of them are like, some of the articles are like, some people never recover. And I was like, oh, that's me too. But I think, especially writing my memoir, that process was kind of coming out of the burnout and sort of putting the pieces of myself back together in a more functional way and objectifying the pieces of my life to add up to a healthier whole. I think that looking at anybody's life and thinking, hey, I want to make this useful for someone else, separates yourself emotionally enough that you can have perspective. I don't know if that happened to you, but it happened with me.
Yeah, it has happened with me. I think just more through growing up more than anything else and maturity and realizing that the stuff that feels so life or death in the moment rarely, if ever, is.
Yeah.
And the stuff that I really value is the stuff that I can hold on to and it keeps me grounded.
Is that like old age? Because, you know, when I don't know if you had this experience, like when you're an actor and you're like, I'm going out of town for the first time. They call and you're like, you have a callback for Fritos.
Right.
Oh, God, I'm going to cancel my ticket.
Yep.
I got to be at that callback. If I'm not, my life is a failure.
Yeah.
I lived my life, you know, for very many years like that.
I did too.
And now I'm like, screw it. Something else will come along.
Of course. But it's impossible to have that perspective until you have that perspective.
Yeah, it's
true. Know what I mean? It's impossible to have that experience until you can look back on it and know. I mean, some people maybe are born with that maturity. I certainly wasn't. I think I was the, you know, cancel everything. I have the callback for Fritos guy.
Welcome to, we were probably there.
God, and I wouldn't book the Fritos commercial.
No, you never book it. If you cancel a trip, you never book it. You never, ever book it. That is Murphy's Law. Hang with me in my MMO. So many places we can go. Hang with me in my MMO. So
8 years ago, my guest, Felicia Day, stood outside of San Diego Comic-Con, handing out bookmarks for her self-made web series, The Guild, shot in her own home with a borrowed camera, unpaid actors, and scavenged props. Now she's the founder and CCO of Geek and Sundry, an award-winning digital entertainment network about gaming and geek culture with more than 1.4 million YouTube subscribers. Coming up, I talk with her about achieving extraordinary success on her own unconventional terms, the downside to getting what you want, and how it feels to trade in the cat-owning stalker secretary outfits she used to wear as an actress to take on a role behind the camera. So, you have the script now. It's 39 pages. It's untitled at the moment. And what do you do? I mean, now you've accomplished, you sort of met the first goal.
Yeah.
You're sitting there with the script. And what's next for you? How does that translate into millions and millions of views just a couple of years later?
It was just sheer grit. I mean, there was no pathway to success at all. I just literally took a drill and started drilling into the mountain.
Right, which is great. I mean, I think people need to hear that, that there is no pathway, that it is, I would say 99% of the time, about that, about grit.
It is. It's about...
It's an underused word, grit, isn't it?
Grit. I think that's just like a Western. It's just a Western term. John Wayne spitting into the grass, yep, kind of thing. No, I really thought it was the best thing ever written. And I showed it to a couple people expecting them to be like, let's shoot tomorrow. And that didn't happen. In fact, I got the opposite of like, I don't understand your language. I don't understand that you could play video games with other humans. Right. This is bizarre to me. This is way too inside. You should write a spec script for like The Office. Go there, you know? And I was so devastated that that this thing that I knew to be true, because what I wrote on the page was true. That was how I saw gamers. That was my life. And I was like, how can you not see the truth of this? And how can you not think this was would connect with people, was stunning to me. And then one of the women in the group who got me into the group, Kim Evey, my producing partner, had been making some sketches for this new thing called YouTube, this brand new thing with the video buffering. And I said,
I've heard of it.
Yeah, familiar. I thought it was just a guy who was playing with a laser, you know, a lightsaber. That was that kid. What happened to that kid? Anyway, so she was like, let's break it up and put it on the web. And I was like, okay, let's take the first 10 pages and shoot on our own dime and make something. And it was so frightening because I never shot anything behind the camera. I was just like an actor. I was a meat monkey, you know?
Right. And until that point, had that been a step that you'd wanted to take at some point? Were you thinking, I'd like to produce, I'd like to direct, I'd like to be in charge?
No, not at all. Not at all. I just wanted to belong to a group. I think that was, I never wanted to have a vision. And it wasn't until I put something down that I needed to get to come to life that I had, you know, found that. And I had a lot of help, you know. Without my friends, I would never have been brave enough. I would never even have had it never occurred to me to put it on film. But the idea that we were going to make something together was really the end goal. We were just going to have this project that we did something and we would have tiny semblance of a control in our lives. And it really was. When we finished filming, when we finished the edits, I was like, this could be enough. If no one sees it, this is enough, because we did something without permission. We did it despite anybody saying that it was worthy of doing. And I think that's a big, big accomplishment in life if you can do that. And it's a way to make your imprint, because waiting for somebody to be like, you go. I mean, that's never going to really allow you to do your greatest work, I don't think.
Which is what I was trying to explain to that actor and that I tried to explain to
Ryan
all
Gosling.
Actors. Ryan Gosling. He knows he can do it. If you can control something in this industry, you've accomplished a lot.
Anything, one thing,
yeah.
Your whole life. Like people look at like, hey, what happened to that guy? He made one film. I'm like, that's enough. Mm-hmm. If you're in this industry, you should realize anything that gets made is enough.
Yeah, it kind of is.
Yeah.
I also feel that way about people who write books. I mean, if the act of putting words on a page is tremendously hard.
Yeah. I talk about fan fiction in my book. And
you started writing it, like as a kid, you started writing fan fiction.
Yeah, I was like, Perry Mason is my secret lover. I have a spreadsheet where he lives right here. And no, it was absolutely ridiculous. But yeah, I think a lot of people demean fan fiction. You know, fan art is a little less demeaned. But the idea that you shouldn't take other people's tools and start building a house is kind of bizarre to me. Even if you're writing Perry Mason fanfic, everyone's Perry Mason fanfic is going to be different. You know, you write a paragraph about a cat, everybody's paragraph is different. So you're expressing yourself in a unique way. And if those are the training wheels you need, or if that's the ultimate goal, you should feel free to do that, because if you're creating and expressing your unique point of view, you're doing what you should be doing, because nobody else could do it the way you're doing
it. You just said two things, one that inspired me, one that made me feel bad. The first made me feel bad was you said you shouldn't feel bad about using other people's tools to build a house. And I saw you very briefly at Comic-Con, but when I was there, I was trying to articulate sort of what was bugging me about it. And part of it was, I think, that idea that I wasn't recognizing that you could take somebody else's tools and have that be turn that into your own house. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, when I see cosplay and when I see all this fanfic and stuff, part of me is going, yeah, but it's somebody else's thing. Like, why aren't you making your own thing?
Mm-hmm.
So I that's what you just said is making that very clear to me now. And yeah. So now I feel bad. So I'm acknowledging and releasing that to the wild. And I'm saying that makes perfect sense to me. And the thing that you said that's inspiring, I've already forgotten. But it really inspired me.
I think that's an interesting point. I think, you know, I tend to rebel against anything mainstream. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm an indie kid at heart. I did this to break Hollywood a little bit. Like, if I could put a crack in the world that had denied me my due or what I wanted to do, what my heart wanted for so long, and change their minds about something, I felt like that was a victory. And I do understand the point of view of looking at fan culture and being like, hey, you're being used by them. Whenever I see all these Marvel trailers like trickled out, like throwing, you know, food into the pond,
right,
and people get so excited, and I have to be like, you know what, let people be excited. You see the Hollywood machine because you're in the Hollywood machine, but you are discounting somebody's enjoyment of that world and having that be a part of their life. And, you know, I rebel against the marketing of it, mm-hmm. the big machine of it, of using people, because I don't like people to be used. But at the same time, if somebody has joy in creating Iron Man / you know, Nancy Drew fan fiction, like, I think that's the best, because that's their original work. That's their original interpretation of something.
I'm really now excited about the Iron Man Nancy Drew fan fiction.
I mean, she would school him. He is kind of a dick. She would put him in his place.
The guild runs for six, you're calling them seasons, but I guess just
years.
Increments of episodes. But was it literally 6 years?
It was
of
six.
Your life?
Yeah, it was 6 years where we did the show, and basically a feature every year.
Yeah.
So it was a lot, and I was the only writer the whole time, and it was just me and my producing partner after year one, like doing everything ourselves out of our houses, even through season six.
And it became a kind of phenomena on YouTube.
It was a cult classic. Actually, it was when we moved to Xbox where we kind of reached our audience in a huger way, because they really featured us a lot. And we met millions of people who are gamers, who liked our stories, and they supported us in really big ways. We started on YouTube. We had a PayPal button where we Kickstarted before Kickstarter was existing, and got through to the point where we could get a deal where they didn't even own the show, the Xbox. So it was kind of like the business side is very impressive to business people, but it was really just me being like, I can make this without you, so make me a deal.
Uh-huh. And what does that mean, make me a deal? So somebody was paying to produce it for you?
Yeah, paying us. We had a sponsor who paid for the episodes, and we could pay everybody up front. And believe me, I still shot my house. I still did commercials to pay my bills, but everyone was compensated to keep the band together, so to speak, for so long. And that was really the main goal, to not sell my thing to get into the development and never get out, because I saw a lot of web series do that, and I didn't want that for my fans.
So it sounds like at a certain point you really transitioned from the person who's going, need me, want me, love me, to the person who's saying, I'm controlling this whether you want it or love it or not.
Yeah, no, the independence of it, and the fact that our fans crowdfunded us. I mean, that was not a thing. It was not existing. We had a PayPal button. I sold DVDs off my kitchen floor. Like, all the stories in the book are real. Like, those, we were so fulfilled by the fans, and I did not need to please the Hollywood people anymore. I could please my fans. And the fact that we could shoot in our house and we had the means to do it through their support was so liberating. So I was able to be choosy and turn down networks and turn down producers who were quite amazing. Just, they didn't know the web world, and I didn't want to risk giving them everything because of their stature, which they expected to get everything from us, and lose control and risk alienating my audience.
When the guild ended in 2012,
mm-hmm.
had you started your company yet?
Yeah. So the season six was funded by YouTube. That was part of the package for Geek & Sundry, my company that I started in 2011. So the guild ended right as 2013 started.
And what was the idea behind Geek and Sundry?
So YouTube came to town and invested in 100 original channels. And everybody from Ashton Kutcher to, Fine Brothers and people on the web, professional, big companies were vying for this. 5,000 people applied. And I had the option to be on a regular on a TV show or try to do one of these channels. And I really, I picked the channel, not really knowing what I was getting into. I did not understand that I was creating a business versus like, let's just produce a lot of content. And that was, kind of one of the reasons why I started burning out, because the infrastructure of a business is very, very dissimilar to pre-production, production, and post-production of actual creative videos.
Well, tell me what the difference is, because I don't think I understand fully.
I mean, just consider you have an infrastructure to market, to complete, to do sponsorship, to do all the financial logistics, architecture of employees, office space.
And so how did you even understand how to create that?
I had two partners, but listen, you know, when you have such a huge influx of pressure, and we were expected to produce dozens of hours of content in 3 months, it was just the volume was quite a bit. We scaled instantly. And I don't mean to complain, because God knows what an amazing opportunity it was to create a company from scratch. It was just the support and my background in that area wasn't there, so that not only was I scrambling to be the face of the company, I was trying to be involved logistically in all these other things. The responsibility of the company financially was on my shoulders, and the guild needed to end. And that really was the key, where my identity that had been built on the show and the fans, I couldn't devote the time to it I needed to, and it was time to let it go. And that's when I really had a breakdown, which I talk about in my book.
You do talk about it in your book. It sounds like you had a kind of classic, you had panic attacks and you had depression and all of that. And how were you able to manage your life during that time?
I didn't manage it. It was terrible. I almost quit. I almost drove over a bridge. I'm one of those people who doesn't, you know, I don't know how to say no sometimes. Now I do a lot better, but I always put other people first. I think it's kind of a people-pleasing trait in a way. So I could not say no, because when you're a small business person, if you say no, you're saying no to everybody who's dependent on you and your company. So that extra pressure made it hard for me to be like, I can't show up here. I can't do this hosting thing. I can't write this thing. I can't. And I said yes, and I just eventually just withered mm-hmm. from the inside, and my brain broke apart, and I would have constant, you know, ideations of just like, please just let it end. What can I do to pull the plug on everything? And it was a very tough time. And I hope, you know, hopefully by experiencing, you know, relaying my experiences there, other people, if they're going through something like that, will be able to be stronger to build a plug and just say no. Because like I learned, like we just talked about the Fritos commercial, like you could say no to anything and you could live with the consequences no matter what. And that certainly wasn't at the time in my wheelhouse.
How did you pull yourself out?
I got therapy. I got a lot of medical help. I had a severe medical problems in a lot of ways, mental and physical. And I had to prioritize those over the needs of the company and appearing places and being a personality. And, you know, I can't say that it was definitely the harder way to go than just being on a show and showing up to set and, you know, being fabulous every day, which would have been fun. But I am ultimately a better person and much more mature. And the reason why I wrote the book was the lessons that I mostly took from that sort of breaking of myself and putting myself back together and getting perspective of, yeah, I'm successful. How am I here? Why did I not understand that success can bring as many burdens and problems as failure?
Notorious B.I.G. said it a long time ago, more money, more problems.
Yeah.
I hope that was Notorious B.I.G. because I'm going to look like such a fraud.
It's okay. I can't pronounce half the elves from Lord of the Rings.
And then you sold Geek and Sundry.
I did. I sold it, and I am so happy. Like, I go to work happy every day.
Because the weight of it's not on your shoulders as much?
Yeah, so I sold the company to Legendary last year after YouTube stopped funding the original channels. Now they're doing original funding of just, like, movies and stuff, which is really cool. I'm excited for that to happen. But, you know, the whole company aspect, you know, was sometimes successful, sometimes not, and it was just something they didn't want to continue, which was such a relief in a way that, because YouTube is a very unique ecosystem, and I was probably 10 years too old to try to be a vlogger. Mm. You know, that is a very unique type of entertainment, a very unique audience. And it wasn't necessarily the audience for the Guild. The Guild was more like Buffy people. It was Xbox. It was some YouTubers, but it wasn't one-to-one. And, you know, my foray into sort of being a personality online, first of all, I hated it. I wasn't good at it. And
well, what do you mean?
Just, you know, being a host of a show as Felicia Day versus an actor. I didn't have the training wheels to figure out that transition in a way. And especially negative comments on YouTube kind of crushed me.
But you still do a lot of that. You still do a lot of hosting.
I do now, but I had never done that.
I see. So you had to learn how to be comfortable.
I did learn how to be comfortable, and it was on a public stage. Right. So then when you have people like, she's so awful. She's the worst. I hate this show. I hate everything about her. She's old looking. Her hair looks like crap. You know, YouTube is a cruel place, and seeing that every day, especially when I was risking something that I wasn't comfortable with. You know, when you're secure, you're like, okay, say I'm crappy. I know I'm not crappy. But if you're like, oh my gosh, maybe I am terrible at this, that was when it really started affecting me a little bit more directly because my armor wasn't fully formed yet.
You wrote what I thought was a really interesting chapter on Gamergate, which I didn't understand until I read your book. I didn't really understand what it was. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think for people who aren't in the gaming world, it either you haven't heard of it, or like for me, who just sort of observed it from afar, it didn't really register. But it really speaks to sort of larger currents in the culture.
I think there is an undercurrent there that I actually had spoken about in the chapter before that incident happened. I had a chapter on negative comments because it was so important to me to talk about the negativity that I experienced and, you know, the country music video I talk about and other incidents and hate that I've gotten over the years, especially being a woman in gaming. A very small minority of aggressively anti-change, anti-woman were there always underneath. But it wasn't the majority. It wasn't what I knew about gaming. And so when I started being sniped by it over the years, it was bad. And then when I got an influx of it once, I almost broke. And then the ultimate message of the chapter was just be who you are. Don't let somebody who hates your work influence your life choices. And then that happened, which was an incident where a woman had her boyfriend manipulate an underground board to attack her for basically cheating on him. And he pathologically collected all these things about her and sort of mobilized against her a hate group. And that hate group was sort of named Gamergate after a while by a conservative actor who gave him a name, and it became this pseudo anti-liberal political movement in a sense amongst people who did
not
want...
A kind of anti-PC. I mean, I guess that's how they would think of themselves.
They would think of themselves anti-PC. They use terminology as like social justice warrior, which sounds cool to me, but they use it as an insult, which is like, okay, basically they don't think it's important or relevant to have a representation of women or minorities or differing curtailing of any of the themes of video games that they know. It's really an ownership thing over do you embrace the evolution of gaming to include more voices and diverse backgrounds, or do you not? So that kind of – but the roots of it were this terrible kind of mob on this poor woman. And so I wrote a piece about how over the months you know, that incident had made me think differently about gaming and had made me not feel like, hey, all gamers are my friends now. And I was attacked for it, and people put my address online, and I put a lot of details in there, which, you know, I mean, I don't even like talking about it because, first of all, it riles all them up. You know, there's this undercurrent now that I hate gamers, which is, and it's just not even accurate, but, and it hurts me because I feel like I identify as a gamer, and to have people who are trying to push me out of something that literally that's who I am, that's my identity is hurtful, but I'm not going away. And the fact that I could share about negativity, because that's just a, you know, an extreme example of it, but negativity is there on the internet a lot. And especially, you know, women experience a lot of it. And if I can make people braver in the face of it and just be proactive with their positivity as they are with their negativity, then I think it's it was worth putting it down paper.
I love how eloquent she is about being a geek and being a woman in, you know, both on the internet but also in real life, and kind of integrating that into your like daily reality.
She's had to deal with like so much of like the male geeks like hating on female geeks so that we don't have to. And so any words that she puts out, I will read.
It was surprising to me, I guess, just to read about, it shouldn't have been, I guess, but I always think of the gaming community as pretty inclusive.
It is. That's the bad part. You have a really small vocal minority who were surfing. You know, it's terrible. It gives gaming, which I consider a place of inclusivity and joy and creativity, a bad name. And I resent that, especially when there are people who are so fervent in their ownership of it, which is proactive negative ownership.
As challenging as it's been for you in Hollywood and in gaming and in sort of geek culture, do you feel like being female has compounded that, made it harder, or has it provided advantages for you?
I think both. I mean, I think in Hollywood it's even harder because it's more endemic, where what women should be and what men should be and how men relate to people. Like, if you go to a party at a Hollywood, like, the guys are talking to the guys and the women talk to the women, unless the woman's hot, and then the hot woman gets to talk to the guys, mm-hmm. but only because they're sexually attracted to her. And if they're not, she's not available, then forget it. She's just a tease. So, like, you're trapped in a lot of social rules, which I kind of stand outside and I kind of look at it. I'm like, wow, how do I fit in here? I'm going home to play video games. So that's just not something that I necessarily feel trapped by, because I feel like the work at least will excel. In gaming, you know, I think obviously, you know, especially when I first started out, women were not as vocal about loving games. And I just represent myself as I am. I don't represent myself as for all women gamers. I'm just like, here I am. I just happen to be female. And I resent it when people are like, there's gamer and then there's women gamers. Like, no, we're all gamers. I could speak on a panel that's not about women in gaming. Thank you. I could speak about gaming. So there is sort of a struggle in that. But I do think that especially in gaming, the extremity of the negativity actually pushes the culture to be more outspoken, the leaders in the culture to be more outspoken about this is not cool. So in fact, I think you could foment more change in gaming because it's an evolving form of entertainment versus Hollywood, where there's just endemic gender roles that will, I don't think, ever be changed.
Yeah, it's a funny thing about Hollywood. And I feel like that conversation is just starting now, where it's been so sort of calcified in the roles that you're talking about. And I think finally, women and people of color are really agitating for change. And what's interesting about it is when you see female directors and female stars who don't look a certain way or act a certain way, like, those projects have become financially successful, which is all ultimately Hollywood cares about.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I think you see a busting of sort of the old boys club. I mean, if you look, the old Judd Apatow, you know, circle was all guys. Mm-hmm. Like, look at the Freaks and Geeks. The women didn't, were not lifted up with that. Look at Edgar Wright. As much as, I mean, I adore Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg, and like, my heart would be like, I want to be one of their gang. But it's mostly the guys who work together.
Right.
And if you look at that and look at women, you know, I think there's a mindset that's being shaken off, that one woman's success basically takes the slot.
Hmm.
And that women can't help other women and band together and create with other women, in that because there's only one slot. So sorry, lady, but just it's mine.
Right.
And it's scarcity. But the more you just kind of, even the playing field a little bit, then everyone doesn't feel like my success is basically your success is my failure. And I think it was more pressure on women and minorities, in that there were just fewer representations out there and fewer slots, really. And now I think you see with all sorts of entertainment, you see the audience actually is craving differing points of view and the rewarding more. And therefore, there's more to go around.
Where's your focus now?
I obviously my book. And now that that's out, I've been developing a television show for myself, whether it's TV or digital. I don't know. It's half hour comedy again. And so that's really my
and
next step.
And what do I play on that show?
What do you play? I'll call you, believe me. Every time you're in everything I love. I'm always like, why can't I be in that with him?
You can be.
Just drop my name. Yeah,
I will.
Fine.
Every time I will.
I know this girl. She's a redhead. She's a quirky secretary. Does she carry laundry? I know the perfect person. yeah, so that's my next step. And, you know, I still am the creative officer for my company, and I have a lot of employees, and we're, you know, with Legendary, not only do we make content for YouTube, but we're working on like other platforms. Like, we do live streaming 6 days a week, and we're developing television shows. So all sorts of different kinds of content. I really like being behind the camera too and making things, because, you know, that's fulfilling, and hopefully will see me through my old years.
How do you think of yourself now as somebody in the entertainment industry versus the Felicia who showed up in Hollywood.
I still feel like I'm an outsider. I'm never going to fit in, I don't think. Which is fine. I love being on the fringes. I love pushing the envelope. I like doing things first. That's why I stay in digital, because you can't really innovate in traditional Hollywood. It's very structured. Mm-hmm. It's done. They perfected it. But digital is starting to sort of invent new walls. And that's where I want to be. And I always enjoy, whether I'm a performer or a creator or a business person, those are the things that give me joy to invent new ways of delighting people, really.
And it's interesting because, though, I mean, I think you've identified what's true, which is that those walls are crumbling. And, you know, you have a great advantage in that nobody knows what's next, because technology is changing our industry so much. And being at the forefront of that, I would assume, is an enormous advantage.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I'm almost too old. Like, I'm the grandma of the internet. If you, the real next step are these 15-year-olds who have 3 million people that on the drop of a hat can just follow them. And right. They're the next Beatles. Like, it's a phenomenon that is a new form of entertainment, a new kind of star. And I think it's fantastic that a kid can just be in Omaha and start shooting something in their closet and become a superstar overnight. Like, that's kind of crazy. That's a democracy that never would have happened before. And I love it.
Right. There's that meritocracy that you were yearning for.
Yes.
When you first showed up.
Finally, some meritocracy. I love it.
All right. Before we wrap up, we conclude every episode of How to Be Amazing with something called the Amazing Five. I have five categories. I will ask for a recommendation in each of these categories.
Okay.
So as a new author yourself, I will start with book.
I have to say that, I guess if you want to create, I would say The Artist's Way is an amazing book. It's by Julie Cameron. It has a lot of like spiritual stuff that you could skim over if that's not your boat. It's very oovy groovy. But the regimen of journaling every day, creatively exploring yourself and kind of figuring out what.
Creatively exploring yourself, easy.
Yeah,
this is
in a porny way.
Family,
it's a porn so. Book. It's basically anime porn. No, it's like a workbook on yourself. And I think I did it a couple times. And one of the times I did it with my group was the reason I did The Guild. So if you're looking for a little bit of structure, that's a great way to start to create.
The Artist's Way. Music.
Oh, wow. I mean, I'm a big fan of Britpop. Like, I love like Robin and, you know, the Arctic Monkeys and stuff like that. I don't know if I have anything innovative to say. I would say that if you want some classical, Ravel is always my favorite because it's very cheesy and romantic.
What did you love to play as a violinist?
I love playing anything smarmy, where I could show off and glide around like a gypsy player. Like something you play at an Italian restaurant to get really good tips that really might not be that hard, but it's flashy. Saison and those kind of things. Nothing dignified, believe me.
Is there a difference between a violin and a fiddle, or are they the same thing?
A fiddle has a little bit flatter bridge normally, so you could play more chords. I never was excelled at that because I was snobby and I wanted to abandon my Southern roots. And now I kind of was like, oh, that would be great to be able to do.
Well, you probably could.
No.
Do you still play? You do, right?
Slightly. I don't have time for it. It's kind of hard. I don't know if you're a musician and you haven't practiced for a while and you pick it up and just suck and you're like, I'm a terrible person. That's kind of how I pursue violin.
Right. But I mean, that's it. You just said something telling, which is I suck, and in parentheses, at violin, and therefore I'm a terrible person, is what you said.
You are very insightful. I'll call you next week for therapy.
All right. But I just, as we talked about you sort of maturing and growing out of that.
Oh, did I say I was totally mature?
No, you did not. You okay. Did not make any claims to total maturity or enlightenment.
I don't have
I
it.
Just want to point out that you equated being rusty on the violin with being a terrible person.
True.
And I'm here to tell you that those two things are separate.
Thank you. I'm going to hold myself tonight and sob and think of you. It's going to be really beautiful. Cathartic.
Food.
Oh, I mean, what? Give me a city.
Okay, you want to go? We can go geographically. What do you consider your hometown?
My hometown would be Austin.
Okay,
I consider Austin my hometown.
So Austin, give me food in Austin.
Every single time I go to Austin, I mean, Austin has some amazing. Salty Sow is one of my favorite restaurants in the country. It's just this fantastic restaurant. That
Salty
has
Sow, like pig.
Salty Sow, yeah. Okay. But every time I go to Austin, I go to Magnolia Cafe at 2 a.m. and I get queso and chips, cherry pancakes, and turkey tacos.
Yeah, those three things sound great together.
The perfect meal.
Movie. And movie can encompass anything. I mean, it could be digital, it could be whatever.
Yeah, my favorite movie of all time is Bringing Up Baby. I've watched that movie probably 300 times.
I don't think I've ever seen Bringing Up Baby.
It's Cary Grant. He plays a nebbish dinosaur paleontologist. And Katherine Hepburn, who's a screwball heiress who owns a tiger. And it's probably the most crazy movie you've ever seen. It's the funniest. It was a complete bomb. It's Howard Hawks. And he's one of my favorite directors, and they're some of my favorite actors. And she plays this crazy woman, and they fall, you know, it's a romantic comedy. But, you know, I love those kind of, that era of movies because the women characters were so good. They weren't just like cliches. They were wacky oddballs, and that's the epitome.
Right. As a wacky oddball, you love the wacky oddballs.
I do, in fact, love the oddballs.
And finally, miscellaneous, anything from your life that you would recommend to somebody else?
Wow. I would recommend, I mean, anything for my life? Like, I mean, my book is my life, but
you're not allowed to say your own thing. I'm turning it over so you can't even look at it.
I definitely would encourage anybody to take improv classes because your subconscious is cleverer and warmer and more enjoyable than you would ever know. And when I've been in improv class, I've felt freer than I ever have. And the funniest people tend to be like lawyers and doctors. And
really?
Yeah, because they have so much more in their toolbox than just a random actor who wants to be an actor, right? They have such a diverse point of view. People can play with their tools, which is a weird way to put that. Sorry. So I would say no matter who you are, improv class will improve your life.
A fantastic recommendation.
Thank you very much.
Felicia Day, I want to thank you so much for all of your work and I think inspiring so many in particular, and I don't mean to categorize you, but women, I think, in gaming and in sort of geek culture, I think they need to hear from people like you. So I think that's important and impressive. And thank you for being amazing.
Thank you for being amazing, Michael and Black.
Oh. How to Be Amazing is brought to you by PRX. Like How to Be Amazing on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @HTBA_show. And check out our website at howtobeamazingshow.com. How to Be Amazing is produced by Jennifer Brennan and Mary Shimkin. It's recorded at Argo Studio in New York City. Today's show is mixed and edited by Barry O'Halloran with music composed by Chad Crouch. I'm Michael Ian Black.